The Spectator magazine is the greatest magazine in the English language. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online to see for yourselves. Also, against my advice as editor, we're giving away a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Given that you're spending 12 quid, you can do the maths. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. But don't hurry, because this offer probably loses us money.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them out loud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on the podcast this week, Max Jeffrey interviews Ahmad Massoud, an Afghan resistance leader based in Tajikistan. Former prisoner David Shipley ponders the power of restorative justice. Patrick Kidd argues that the Church of England must do more to encourage people to volunteer. Cindy Yu asks if the famed tiger mother is an endangered species. And Hugh Thompson reviews Mick Conifery's new book, Fallen, which explores mountaineer George Mallory's tragic 1924 Everest expedition. Up first, Max Jeffrey.
It's fighting season in Afghanistan again. When the Americans were in charge, after the poppy fields had been harvested in late spring, and the madrasas in Pakistan that supplied the Taliban with fanatical soldiers had finished for the term, the Islamists kicked off the fighting. Between 2001 and 2021, around 200,000 people died, including 453 Britons. Now, an insurgent group called the National Resistance Front are starting the annual springtime assaults, this time against the Taliban government. In the past 31 days, we have staged 31 attacks on Taliban, only in Kabul. Ahmad Massoud, the NRF leader, cheerily tells me from Tajikistan, where he directs his troops in exile. We have not even had one person captured. The NRF's latest hit, he says, was 500 metres from the presidential palace. With proper support, ideally Western arms, he says he can destroy the country's Islamic Emirate and install a democratic republic. I'm 100% sure it is possible to defeat the Taliban, he says. The NRF came together when Western forces fled during the Taliban takeover. As the Islamists swept from Kandahar in the south up to Kabul, Afghan army soldiers joined a group of fighters in Panjshir in the north. Now, from a small area of land they still hold, they conduct guerrilla operations in half of Afghanistan's 34 provinces. Massoud says he doesn't have the firepower to launch total assault on the Taliban administration, so his NRF missions are limited. A couple of men with AK-47s may carry out a drive-by shooting on a checkpoint. A squad might ambush a Taliban camp at night. The NRF uses weapons left behind by the Americans and the Soviets and tops up its supplies from Afghanistan's black markets. Massoud says his guerrilla operation is ready to do more. I don't need soldiers from the Pentagon or from the Ministry of Defence, he says. However, we are all alone and empty-handed. The NRF runs a serious lobbying operation, with an office in Washington, D.C., and friendly senators such as Lindsey Graham making their case in Congress. Helpfully, Massoud appeals to Western sensibilities. He is an alumnus of King's College London and Sandhurst. He is friendly with Emmanuel Macron. He dresses in a white Oxford shirt. He is also out to promote his book, available for £7.49 on Amazon Kindle. Massoud trades on the reputation of his father, Ahmad Shah Massoud, a hero of Afghanistan's resistance against the Soviets. Back in the late 1970s and 1980s, Commander Massoud repelled several attempted invasions of Panjshir, and when the Taliban tried to take over Afghanistan in the 1990s, he led the Northern Alliance of rebel groups against them. The US and UK worked with the alliance to depose the Taliban in 2002. Massoud had been a Western intelligence asset for decades. MI6 had helped train his troops in the 1970s, and by the late 1980s, American operatives were hand-delivering him a monthly stipend of $400,000 in today's money. 3 years ago, French and American intelligence services considered backing Massoud Jr. against the Taliban. His bloodline clearly attracted them. But not enough. Massoud Jr. says he met with a lot of military personnel before the Taliban's assault, including Nick Carter, the then head of the British Army, but he says he wasn't given weapons or intelligence. We were left completely alone, he says. He fled Kabul as the Taliban closed in on the capital, and from there tried to negotiate with the Islamists in return for a ceasefire. He asked for free nationwide elections, but says he was told to surrender or die. He took a helicopter to Tajikistan. Massoud met the Taliban's foreign minister, Amir Khan Muttaqi, for talks in Tehran in 2022, mediated by the Iranians. Massoud was told if he dropped his resistance and returned to Afghanistan, he could take charge of a Taliban ministry. You say that I should return to Afghanistan. Very good, he recalls his reply. Let's all agree on a transition period, a constitution, and an election. Mutaki said Massoud's demands were un-Islamic, and the talks ended there. Massoud's position seemed obviously unrealistic. Why would the Taliban give him anything? But he thinks he's right to keep fighting for a democratic republic. Afghans are desperate for elections, he claims. The Taliban do not possess the support of the mass of the people. We do, he says. When we talk, Massoud barely mentions poverty or education. In the last 2 years, Afghanistan's GDP has shrunk by a quarter. Half of the population is now in absolute poverty. Education for girls stops at the age of 11. Perhaps you should be fighting for social reforms instead of regime change. Massoud says he has a proposal for Britain. If we fund the NRF, it would help sort out Britain's problem with illegal immigration. Last year, more small boat arrivals were from Afghanistan than any other country. I know that one of the main concerns Europe feels is immigration, he explains. If immigration is an issue, then help us not with boots on the ground, but help those soldiers. They would rather die fighting for their freedom in their country than emigrating and dying in the seas of Greece and crossing the Channel, he says. How many more million will be spent on Rwanda? Is this really a solution? He asks. It's unclear that Afghans would welcome the West having a second go at installing democracy. Resentment still lingers from the last attempt. In Helmand, in southern Afghanistan, the US employed a brutal local warlord, Amir Dado, as their chief of intelligence. When ordinary Afghans crossed him, Dado murdered them and strung their bodies from trees. The US thought to be a useful resource for catching terrorists. Coalition airstrikes, particularly in the south, killed civilians, and the SAS is currently being investigated for war crimes. The coalition troops were not liberators then, and Massoud may not be seen as one now. Why didn't it work out before? Asks Massoud. Because the military strategy and doctrine adopted by our friends and the international force and the Afghanistan army, it was completely wrong, he says. The NRF can depose the Taliban using the same tactics his father deployed, he says. Massoud Sr. studied Che Guevara, Mao Zedong, and Regis Debray, a French academic who wrote a manual on guerrilla warfare based on the Cuban Revolution. Massoud Sr. followed Debray's three golden rules: constant vigilance, constant mistrust, constant mobility. If Massoud Jr. gets the weapons he wants and starts a nationwide war against the Taliban, he will fight alongside once-feared warlords such as Ismail Khan and Abdul Rashid Dostum. In 2021, Khan cut a deal with the Taliban and escaped to Iran, while Dostum's forces in Mazar-e-Sharif were easily beaten. Dostum now lives in Turkey, and in interviews refers to himself in the third person as General Dostum. In the 2000s, he was accused of locking captured Taliban in shipping containers and letting them suffocate to death. We all believe and we all agreed on certain values, which is the liberation of Afghanistan, implementing and believing in a process to bring an election based on a legitimate process, Massoud insists. He wants to reassure me that he has consulted the new generation and the leaders among the women. But our time is up. There is no time for the details. We've had an hour. Massoud says goodbye, and his iPhone 15 leaves the call. That evening, an NRF spokesman messages. The book we mentioned, right?
That was Max Jeffrey. Next, David Shipley.
In a week, when the Chief Inspector of Prisons published an urgent notification detailing the horrors of HMP Wandsworth, I found myself revisiting memories of being jailed there for the crime of fraud. Clanging doors, rattling chains, men screaming at night in anguish or despair, or because their cellmate was assaulting them. No help coming. Emergencies unattended for far too long, and people dead as a result. No purpose, no hope, not even the possibility of redemption. Wandsworth is a miserable prison, one which does as much as possible to brutalise, punish and hurt those it jails, and nothing to heal or change them for the better. My mind full of memories of pain, I then travel to Nottingham to see James Graham's new play, Punch, an adaptation of Jacob Dunn's memoir, Right from Wrong. Age 19, Jacob threw a single punch at a stranger, James Hodgkinson. James fell to the ground, struck his head, and died in hospital 9 days later. Jacob went to prison for manslaughter. In that environment, surrounded by drugs and angry young men, where staff and other prisoners just reinforced negative feelings, he might have continued down the path of crime after release. But something changed. Jacob is now a married father of two, who campaigns for healthier cultures in and outside of prison. He credits restorative justice with changing the direction of his life. This process offers victims the opportunity to contact the person responsible with the intent of asking them questions and expressing the harm caused. Jacob was put in touch with James Hodgkinson's parents, David and Joan, via Remedy, a restorative justice organisation. They eventually met, and ultimately Jacob worked with Joan to raise awareness of the risks of throwing even one punch. Jacob described restorative justice to me as all about questions. It's about getting to the bottom of what people's needs are. Punch dramatises this painful, difficult and powerful story with sensitivity. Graham's dialogue is astonishingly real. In the second act, when we finally see the meeting between James's parents and Jacob, I forgot I was watching a dramatisation. I knew little about restorative justice until I started speaking to people who had participated in these schemes. Michael, for instance, suffered a particularly traumatising robbery. After the offenders had been sentenced to 3 years, a probation officer approached him to see whether he'd be open to restorative justice, as an opportunity to ask questions and to allow the perpetrators to explain. Michael thought it sounded useful, and he hoped he'd get some answers. More than 75% of all criminal prosecutions in England and Wales result in a guilty plea. This means there's no trial and little or no explanation of what happened or why. Victims I spoke to found this very hard. They often feel the criminal process focuses on the offender. At the end, the victim still has no idea why the crime happened. Matt is a probation worker I spoke to, who has also experienced a restorative process as a victim. He believes most victims have questions which don't get answered in a normal justice process, such as, why me? Was I unlucky? What's happening to the offender now? Michael's restorative process began with him writing a letter to one of the offenders via an intermediary. The offender's explanation and apology helped, although Michael acknowledges, I keep changing my mind. What he did was terrible. Even so, he likes to think the man has moved on with his life. Nicola Fowler has worked for Remedy since 2005. She was a restorative justice practitioner who worked with Jacob, David and Joan. She told me that good restorative justice must be focused on the needs of all participants and entirely voluntary and informed. There is no requirement for victims to meet those who have wronged them. They may simply wish to have messages or letters passed back and forth. The data supports Remedy's approach. Almost all the victims who participated said it helped them feel safer and recover from the offence, and that it increased their satisfaction with the criminal justice system. If this was all restorative justice did, it would be enough. But it can also help offenders change. As Jacob explained to me, the power of restorative justice is it doesn't allow you to remain ignorant. For most offenders, it increases their understanding of the harm they've done and motivates them not to reoffend. And as Graham remarked, restorative justice is far from the soft, liberal and woolly process people might imagine. In fact, to go into a room with your victim or with the person who has hurt you is, as he put it, hard, muscular and robust. Fowler says that the best way to understand restorative justice is to sit in and watch it take place. That is unlikely to be possible for most people, and punch may be the closest most of us will come to experiencing the power of the processes. I've often wondered how a post-Christian society could build a mechanism for forgiveness and reconciliation when even many Christians struggle with these acts. Punch shows us the power of forgiveness and of the better world we could make. The process isn't always smooth, though, and the play doesn't shy away from that. While Joan managed to forgive Jacob, David didn't. It is not a panacea, but it does provide a different model where victims and offenders recognise one another as people in all their complexity. The play made me think about my own crime and my victims. Victims of fraud may be less obvious than someone who is punched or robbed, but they suffer all the same. I waited 18 months between confessing all to the police and being sentenced. In that time, I often thought about how much I wanted to pick up the phone or send an email trying to explain. Perhaps restorative justice would have helped both my victims and me heal. Perhaps it still could.
That was David Shipley, now Patrick Kidd.
John Betjeman knew that a church cannot run on prayers alone. Let's praise the man who goes to light the church stove on an icy night, he wrote in his poem Septuagesima, going on to celebrate the hard-worked wardens, cleaners, treasurers, the organist, and most of all, the few who are seen in their accustomed pew, come rain or shine. And though they be but two or three, he concluded, they keep the church for you and me. Some vicars today may feel fortunate to garner two or three volunteers. A recent Church Times survey found a worrying decline in numbers taking on the lay roles of warden, secretary and treasurer. Between a quarter and 40% of churches in each diocese had only one warden, not the required two, while more than a fifth were missing one or more other key officers. In rural areas, where clergy numbers have been cut and congregations have fallen, meaning that one overstretched vicar can be responsible for a dozen parishes, this is stark. In the Diocese of Norwich, famed for its number of churches, 267 of them have fewer than a dozen worshippers. In Hereford, 250 get below 20. Reducing clergy, some have observed, does not help to swell numbers. Even in my own parish in Blackheath, South East London, where I am one of two wardens, we need more help. The vicar ran through a Betjeman-esque encomium at the recent annual parochial church meeting, praising the cleaning team, the sidespeople, the readers, those who do the flowers or serve the tea, and all the rest. Some appeared several times. But only one of the five vacancies on the parochial church council, the PCC, was filled. Our flock, though, is lucky to have many sheep. In smaller churches, filling voluntary vacancies is a headache, not helped by an ever-increasing bureaucracy from the centre. Consider the following recent tweets from C of E clergy and volunteers. "No one will be a warden," wrote Michael Roberts, vicar of St Michael's, Cockerham. "The volume of stuff from on high puts them off." Daniel Thompson, rector of Icknield Benefice, wrote, "I am trying to explain the complexity of safeguarding portals and online dashboards to a 76-year-old. From Matt Triggs, PCC secretary at St Mary the Virgin in Nottingham, "Just had an email from our diocese to put reducing climate emissions on PCC agenda. We really don't have the time or manpower." The C of E does love forms. My co-warden and I recently had a two-hour visitation by the Archdeacon. We had to fill out a 16-question form on our makeup and attendance figures, answer 55 more on parish finance, fill out a third form on when the drains were cleaned and the lightning conductor checked, and answer the questions, "Do you have a plan for if the boiler breaks down?" and "How will you make lighting more sustainable?" My co-warden spent a weekend converting the emails by which our maintenance programme is run into a logbook as required, although it wasn't looked at. The important thing for volunteers to realise if they want to stay sane is that they can say no to a lot. Our vicar is blessed, he may not always feel so, that a source in the diocese described my church to a colleague as the one with the difficult wardens. When our diocese was urging churches to close during COVID, we stood firm and worked out how to stay open. It was worth it, and only possible because we made our own decisions, rather than having to follow a diocesan blueprint. Never forget, the parish is not the branch office of the diocese, says Marcus Walker, rector of Great St Bart's in the City of London and the co-founder of the Save the Parish campaign group. He goes on to say it is an independent charity that occasionally sends voluntary grants to the diocese. He adds that the mentality of some leaders of the C of E towards volunteers is, I quote, "They're bloody lucky to be allowed to help, and if they don't like it, they can just..." Well, here he uses a Vulgate phrase that may be translated as nunc dimittis. Vanishing volunteers is not just a church problem. The Department for Digital Culture, Media and Sport reports that numbers of regular volunteers has fallen by 11% in 8 years. My vicar, Nicholas Cranfield, says there has been a noticeable shift in availability. Early retirees are on grandparenting duty, and more women work full-time. Some employers ban staff from volunteering in case it damages their professional reputation. "There are not so many qualified accountants out there," he says. At the same time, there is a risk that in some places the church can look like a closed club. Cranfield adds, "The church was once seen as part of the community and people helped out, even if not worshippers, because it was something valuable that needed help to preserve." some of these generously donated to our organ restoration fund, because they felt a church should have a good instrument. And as the 1,500 people in Blackheath who attend our Christmas Eve carol service outside church attest, there are more who feel drawn to church than those who make up the congregation on Sundays. I see this call to serve in my aunt, who has no religious faith but lives near a church in East Budley, Devon, and has joined the cleaning roster and mows the churchyard. She sees it as her community duty to help her neighbours to worship while she drinks coffee and listens to the bells. We need to encourage more like her. I believe that more people will help if you ask them, if you make it easy for them, and if you thank them. At Easter, a Church Times article compared the composition of the C of E to an egg. The focus is always on the bright, rich, colourful yolk, that is, the clergy. But it is the volunteers in the pews who form the transparent part that binds the church together. And if you are not careful, it can so easily run away.
That was Patrick Kidd, now Cindy Yu.
What's it to do with me if your boyfriend wants to break up with you? Or if you cried, or had a fight? These are not things that I, as a supervisor, care about. I'm not your mother. All I care about is results. Our relationship is just employee-employer. In a series of videos posted on Douyin, China's version of TikTok, Chinese tech executive Qu Jing was a little too candid about her management style. Sharply dressed and with hair cut formidably short, she said she expected her staff to be on call 24 hours a day, including at weekends, even at the cost of their personal relationships. If Qu thought these videos would give her a girl boss image, she was wrong. They went viral and she became a national hate figure. Watching the clips, I shudder to think of the life I might be living had my mother not taken me out of China when I was a child. The graft starts young. In my 3 years of primary school in Nanjing, the days were 10 hours long, after which there would be homework until bedtime. Weekends were spent going between piano lessons, swimming lessons, and painting lessons. Mum was half driven by ambition and half by fear. All the parents watched each other and their children closely, anxious that theirs might fall behind. They were made even more neurotic by the fact that they could have only one child on whom to dump all their hopes and ambitions. Teachers add to the competitiveness by ranking students according to their grades, so everyone always knew who was top of class and who was bottom. As pupils get older, exams become more pressured, culminating in a Gaokao, the university entrance examinations, which are held nationally over 3 days. Landing a place at a top-tier Chinese university can be as hard as getting into Harvard. Then, work. For years, the Chinese have talked about 996, a working pattern of 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. That's a 72-hour week. Tech mogul Jack Ma once asked, "If you don't 996 when you're young, when are you going to 996?" The idea that for many, the answer would be never, didn't seem to occur to him. Even in industries where 996 isn't the norm, employees commonly compare themselves to chives and their employers to chive cutters. After each harvest, more workers will come, just like the fast-growing chive, giving employers free rein to get all they can from each batch. People also use the word juan, which refers to the endlessly intensifying competition, but with fewer and fewer rewards. Back in the 2000s, Mum could already imagine the life I'd have if we stayed in China, so we left when I was 9. I remember the process of de-acclimatization from the Chinese regime. After school ended at 3:30 p.m, I was at a loss for what to do, given there was barely any homework. I learned that English kids don't sit straight in class or fold their arms neatly in front of them. My classmates would giggle behind their hands at the strange robotic tics which had been drilled into me by Chinese teachers. 20 years on, I'd like to think I've kept some of that drive, but I probably wouldn't last a month in a Chinese office. Some of my peers in China have also started to rebel. It has become popular to lie flat, to take an almost philosophical stand against competition and traditional milestones. No job, no marriage, no house. Others talk about being full-time children, making a virtue out of still living with their parents. The trend has become so popular that Xi Jinping himself has waded in, warning young people that lying flat is negative thinking and that they must continue to eat bitterness. The government has banned 996, but something like it is still expected by many companies. Just as my mum and her friends had no choice but to compete, students, employees, employers, companies are all in an endless race. It's partly down to China's size. Competition will always be fierce in a country of 1.4 billion people. And partly down to the gulf between rich and poor. the top 10% of the population and 2/5 of the national income, akin to the US. Add millennia of Confucianism to that, and you have what one Chinese Kiwi academic described as a combination of, quote, unrestricted global capitalism and a Confucian culture of hierarchy and obedience. In this environment, several tech workers have died from suicide or overwork in the past few years. And the situation is getting worse. The Chinese Communist Party's crackdown on tech giants has meant that the once great companies are reducing headcount and freezing hiring, while China's youth unemployment rate is roughly 15%. Chu's comments were essentially punching a bruise. So, I actually feel a little sorry for her. She's not an easy character to defend. In another interview, she is unrepentant about forgetting one son's birthday and the other son's age. But she's hardly the only demanding boss in the country. Competition, discipline, and obedience to authority are baked into people's lives from school to retirement. As one Chinese pundit said on Weibo, Chu's mistake wasn't to think what she thought, but to say it out loud. And does Chu not also have a point? The Chinese work ethic, or rather the Asian work ethic, as similar cultures exist in South Korea, Japan, and India, has been a driver of success, and in the success of Asian emigres. The Chinese diaspora consistently outperformed the white majority and most other ethnic groups on grades and earnings. I struggle to believe that's nothing to do with the Asian tiger mother. The West could probably do with a little bit more of that.
That was Cindy Yu. Finally, Hugh Thompson.
George Mallory bookended the 20th century history of Everest with his pioneering attempts in the 1920s to climb the mountain, and with the spectacular discovery in 1999 of his body high up on the north face, preserved by the ice for 75 years after he had failed to do so. His flip remark to a journalist that he was climbing Everest because it was there became mountaineering's most celebrated quote, while masking other less noble reasons. Mick Conathry, the author of this book, has become one of our finest gazetteers of the Himalaya, with successive books on K2, Kanchenjunga, and later exploits on Everest. Now he turns his attention to a great conundrum of mountaineering history. Did George Mallory reach the summit before dying? Along with the moral question it prompts, should he even have tried, with imperfect oxygen equipment, given he was putting not only his own life at risk, but that of his much younger companion, Sandy Irvine, only 22 and fresh out of Oxford University. Mallory belonged to an older generation. He was 37 and had served in the First World War and was climbing with the recklessness of a man who knew this might be his last opportunity to have a go at the summit. Both he and Irvine were last seen on the Tibetan side of Everest, at that point with Nepal closed, the only approach route, heading into the clouds from which they never re-emerged. Books like Fallen can have something of the appeal of a detective novel. At what point was the fatal mistake made that led to their deaths? Mallory had premonitions about what might happen. Before leaving for that fatal attempt on Everest in 1924, he visited Kathleen, the widow of Captain Scott, and confessed to friends he was in two minds about whether he should leave his own wife and small children in Cambridge. In a way, many will recognise, he never quite made the decision himself, but let others make it for him. The Everest Committee were determined that their finest climber would be part of the team, and Mallory's wife, Ruth, did not want to be seen to dissuade him from going. At the heart of it all, as with so many mountaineering disasters, was a clash of personalities. On the previous Everest expedition of 1922, Mallory's fellow climber, George Finch, who was Australian, annoyed him with his sharp elbows and perceived chippy Antipodean attitude. Finch had also managed to climb higher than Mallory using oxygen bottles, which the rest of the team thought was somehow cheating. Only rotters would use oxygen. Now it appears Mallory had told the committee as one of his deferring mechanisms that he would not think of joining the new expedition if Finch was going. So they fired Finch to persuade Mallory, and he was left with little alternative but to prove he was a better climber on the day, whatever risks might be involved. However, Mallory had a fatal flaw, well known to his companions. He was one of those people who were both absent-minded and clumsy with equipment. His leader on the previous expedition, Charles Bruce, had said that, left to his own devices, Mallory would forget his boots. What might be endearing on a stroll in the Cotswolds, your laces are undone again, becomes a liability above 21,000 feet in the death zone of Everest. Mallory, unlike Finch, had never mastered the intricacies of using the large, awkward oxygen bottles, without which Everest becomes even more daunting, particularly if on a pioneering route. Had Mallory resolved his issues with the practical Finch, they would have made a formidable climbing partnership. Instead, he took the young Irvine, who had the great advantage in a climbing partner of doing exactly what he was told, however inexperienced. Other writers, such as Wade Davis, have drawn the analogy with the fatalism of the First World War, in which so many of those early climbers had served. They took far more risks on Everest than would be taken today, and often followed orders blindly. Finch was unpopular because he dared to question authority and perceived wisdoms. He designed the first duvet jacket for himself, an object of derision and then of envy when it became obvious how much warmer it was. When Mallory's body was found by an expedition which had gone to the North Face precisely for that purpose, his thin tweeds were all perfectly preserved, as was the name tape on the back of his shirt. Conifery is particularly good on such granular detail. Irvine's body has never been found, and he is perhaps the more tragic figure, the big, burly rower who had done little mountaineering and whose boundless enthusiasm was sacrificed to the British need to claim the world's highest mountain. The mastermind of the expedition in London was Francis Younghusband, the same man who had shot unarmed Tibetans in the punitive 1903 expedition he led through the Himalaya to Lhasa, one of the least glorious of British colonial ventures. It was not enough to have proprietorially renamed the Tibetan Chomolungma as Everest. The summit was another place that needed conquering. Irvine was the victim of a mindset that used the eagerness of youth as fodder for its own imperial ambition. The memorials to the missing of the First World War could apply equally well to him. And as the expedition was leaving, one of his surviving companions referred to Everest as the finest cenotaph of the world.
And that's everything for this week. If you've enjoyed listening to those articles, why not pick up a copy of the Spectator magazine to read them, and many more in full. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.